You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello. Tamara here, your host. Excited to be with you today. So, culture. I feel like that word gets thrown around a lot. We all know we need one, but what the heck does it even mean and how do we make it happen? I think if you ask 10 people for the definition of culture, you get 50 different answers. And in fact, so I was talking to someone at this fundraising event I was attending the other weekend, and he was telling the table how his company culture is the key to their success. I wish I could say it like he did, like super kind of boisterous in how he said it. So I got all excited and I asked, oh, describe your culture to us. Like, tell me, what does that even mean? He couldn't. He rambled on for about 10 minutes. So now I'm a little suspicious, by the way, of everything he said. But I get that culture has some intangibles. There's a lot of softness to it. But if you can't define, how do you know if it even exists? If you can't put it into words, how do you know if it's working or not working, if you're on track or off track? Well, today's guest, Tabitha Laser, is going to help us unearth what it means to have a successful culture. Tabitha is a senior leader with 25 years of operations and consulting experience in oil and gas, energy, chemical, manufacturing, government, medical fields. The list goes on. She's also the author of the newly released book, Company Culture Killers. This is really interesting. One of the things we talked about that I found fascinating was how the culture of ignorance can kill your organization. All right, let's dig in.
Tabitha, it's so nice to officially meet you and have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I think most people are surprised to learn that I'm an introvert because I don't come across that way at all when I'm out in public.
It's so funny. You're the second person to say that to me. We were just having this conversation the other day about, and in fact, the more I'm in the public eye, I don't know if it's true for you, the more the stronger my introvert side gets too.
Right. It's like you need more downtime.
Yeah.
The more you have to be on, the more you have to turn off.
Okay. So for all of us introverts out there who look like extroverts, how do you switch into like gregarious mode when you have to?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes from an early age. I just kind of swarmed to acting and learned a lot of tips and tricks how to kind of take myself out of myself and become somebody stronger and better. And so it's really, I have like a prep time. It sometimes bugs people before I perform. I need some time just to me to go through my head and make sure everything's aligned. And oddly enough, if somebody like throws a hammer in it right before I go, it completely throws me out of whack. So I'm like, give me my downtime to get prepared and then I'll be on. And then I'll do all the, you know, communications and book signings and everything else. And then I'll go home and sleep for a week.
So, you know, what's funny about that is I have AirPods, you know, the small ones, but I bought big ones, a big Beats, so that like when I'm done keynoting, when I get on the plane, it's very obvious I don't want to talk to anyone because somehow with the small headphones, people still throw those hammers. Like they still talk to you.
Yeah.
If you have the big headphones, people leave you alone.
Yeah. Yeah. I have when I'm in public, I feel like I have to be on, but as soon as I get in my little nest, I just kind of hibernate and crash. So on the plane, I loved it. Like I said, I went through the Myers-Briggs years and years and years ago when I was with General Mills, and it was shocking to everybody, including me, to find out I'm an introvert, really? And it explains so much because I come off kind of false sometimes because I'm trying so hard to come outside of myself that now I explain to people, okay, I'm an introvert and I'm really working hard. And if I come across like, you know, too pushy or whatever, I'm just overdoing it. Just tell me to calm down. And that seems to help, the open transparency up front. But before, it was a challenge. Yeah.
That's funny. So you have a lot of experience, and you put that experience into a new book called Organization Culture Killers, which I love that kind of digging into this stuff. So I'm excited for this conversation. Tell us, Let's just start with what are, from your kind of experience and perspective and maybe even your research, what are the top three killers to culture?
Oh, gosh, that's always been the crux of the matter. I think the biggest killers we have is, one, we don't set clear expectations or communicate them. So that's why I started with that book set with my books, The Deadly Expectation, because if we don't know what we want, how can we expect people to get us there? Mm. You know, so that's a big one. If we don't really know what we want and how to get there, is a huge deadly practice. So I don't believe you can really kill a culture, but you can harm the culture, which will kill your success. So I just wanted a snazzy title, right? Stephen King.
We're
murder.
Killing it.
There's guns and everything on the cover. You know, it's
a cemetery quite, in the office.
I have a question
for you on that. And just to your point about you can't really kill a culture, or you can't, like, culture's not going to die. It just turns toxic, right? Like, there's always a culture. You just may not be the one you want.
Exactly.
I have a question about expectations. Do you find that it's people don't know what they want, or that they have a vision in their head? I know I'm guilty of this. I'll have a vision or an expectation in my head, but I don't communicate it clearly. And then I get disappointed when people don't live up to it. But it's because I haven't communicated what seems clear to me.
Yes. So that's one of the three, right? So you have the expectations. I'll put three to number two now. Three is not being able to communicate. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is due to the way we're, you know, our world is being built right now. We communicate via social media. We do our college and classrooms online more. We have less personal skills, and there's not a lot of training on personal skills. That was another lesson I learned actually with BP when they sent me to some coaching training over in Scotland, locked away in this beautiful mansion with a bunch of world leaders. And it was, if you don't, you can listen with your ears. And that's what everybody always tells us. And then they say, you're not listening. You're not a good listener. Women get that a lot because our brains are going all over the place. But it's not about listening with our ears. It's about listening with all of our senses, including our eyes. And that communicating really needs to tie in body language. And if we take the body language out of it, it's very hard to have strong communications. You and I are just chatting over the phone here. A lot of them are going to video because we need that. We need to be able to see how are people responding. Are they yawning while I'm talking, you know, or different things. And we don't communicate our expectations clearly. We didn't in the past when we had the personal, you know, interactions. And we don't even more now because we've lost even that piece.
Where it's more virtual.
Yeah. So in my Leading Beyond Best keynote series, one of them is communicating better. And I think that's really important for especially the youth, the young leaders coming in to learn so that they can be better than us versus making the mistakes.
Yeah. Before we go on to number three, can we dig into this one? Because I know I actually had a question further down, but since we're on the topic, give us some tools for communicating more effectively. And one of the things that you talk about that I thought was a really interesting way to look at it too is not just what we say or to your point, just listening with our ears. But also, I think, as you call it, behavioral observation or even body language.
Right.
So give us some tips for being better communicators, listeners, because I couldn't agree more. I think half the battle is our interactions with each other.
Yeah. So go watch, what was that, Lie to Me. It's a TV series. And you'll learn a little bit about body language. I had my undergrads in psychology and safety. Psychology and safety engineering, put those two together. But I've always had a fascination with body language, but I really didn't put the pieces together to understand it until, again, that coaching in Scotland. And then that Lie to Me is a great series to watch and just pick up on, look at what he's looking at, you know, look at the different cues that people give. And one of the biggest learnings I've had, it's in an article I have coming up, by far changed my life was the middle finger. You know, in the US, we flip the bird, right? And if you are ever in a conversation where that comes out, you know, watch TV and watch this happen. Simon Cowell does it all the time, right? He'll be smiling and laughing and, oh, you're marvelous. And he's scratching his face with like his cheek with his middle finger.
Right.
And yeah. And I'm here at home watching going, okay, whenever the middle finger comes out, I know you're really upset. It's internal. You may not even realize you're doing it, but whatever's going on, you're upset. And I need to reconsider the way I'm approaching that individual. Well, in Simon's case, a lot of times that middle finger comes out when it's a large group, right? A very large group that does so well that he can't say you did bad because, you know, golly, they didn't do bad. But the finger comes out, I think, because he's going, oh my gosh, I have to pay to fly all of these people to the next round, right? And so in his head, he's thinking of the money it's going to cost him. That's my impression. And I think we can do that a lot in practice by watching TV and watching others. When I do my keynotes, I actually, during intermissions, if we have break time, I'll give a communication bingo where I actually ask people to go around and observe people as they're talking to them and find different body language cues, you know, and get people to initial off on those and why they were, you know, have conversations around why they were doing it. And the more you practice watching for that, the better listener you'll become.
So what are some other, so I have a friend who's a body language expert. And one of the things that she's told me before, and you're so right about the finger, I've done it while listening to other people. And she's come up to me and said, why were you so critical of that person? I'm like, what do you mean? I was smiling. Oh, I was. Yeah. But like saying something that you agree with, but shaking your head no, like are other kind of easy ones for us to hold on to that we could walk away with and go, oh, we need to maybe ask another question to make sure they're really on board.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to step away and reflect, right? And talk to somebody else. Yeah. Did you notice this conversation? If you have a buddy, you know, take your buddy aside and go, what did I do wrong? Or what's going on? They'll a lot of times see things you don't when you're in the passion of talking. Another big one that I love is the feet. Oh. So if you look at somebody's feet and the way they're placed, whether they're sitting or standing, whichever direction their feet are facing is where their attention wants to go.
Oh.
So let's say I'm doing a workshop and everybody's attentive in their feet, but there's one person's feet facing to the door. Now I can look at that. Maybe they have other things they got to get to. Their wife's pregnant, you know, they have to go to the bathroom.
Right.
Or it could just be, this is a waste of my time. I don't want to be in here. And so paying attention to the feet, everybody goes, yeah, well, what can I do about that if they don't want to be around me? Well, one thing, if you Google, look up mirroring, right? Mirroring is we like when others are like us. It's that herd instinct in us, right? And so if somebody's feet are pointed the other way, you want to put yourself, not like blatantly, like I'm going to stand in front of your feet, but you want to put yourself in a position to where you're in front of where their feet are pointing. So you may walk around nonchalantly and move the conversation. If their feet continue to move, then you know it's not that they need to go out that door to do something, but it's that they're not wanting to talk to you. So then you have to pay more attention to those cues as far as what is it that I can get personally for them to engage with me. And a lot of times we come on with our own agenda and we skip the small talk altogether. I'm awful at it. My introvert in me really has to work at the small talk. And you have to do that, right? So as you're pivoting to try to stay in front of their feet, you want to try to grasp their attention with something personal to draw them into you. And then you start mirroring body language, body posture. How are they standing? How are they sitting? If their arms are crossed, that means that they're guarded. I get that all the time as a female talking to men, right? The arms crossed, like, who are you to tell me anything? So I have to work really hard to drop the guard. I'll start with my arms crossed and I'll slowly like scratch my knee and I'll start to uncross my arm. And you'll be surprised once they get locked into the mirroring, they'll start following you. They'll start mirroring you without knowing it. And once you can get the arms uncrossed and the legs uncrossed, and their feet pointed towards you, then you've got them, right? And then they're in and they're listening to you. You've got their attention. And your goal then is to keep it, right? And get through your elevator speech or whatever you need based on what they need. So that's another twist to it is you always, when you approach somebody, you want to be filling their needs, not your own.
So I'm a little bit speechless because I'm thinking about like my next meeting and how I can implement some of this stuff.
Right.
So, which is, I don't know if this is active listening or jumping ahead. I'm not sure which one I'm doing, but, I, like the whole thing about the feed, I'd never heard before. That's really, and it, is, it makes perfect sense if you equate it to something like skiing or snowboarding, right? You point where you're trying to go.
Yes.
So yes. It kind of like, to me, just to wrap my head around that, and the mirroring part of it too. But I want to take a second and talk about the impact, because what I think is so powerful, Tabitha, about what you're saying, it isn't just the whole, look, I get your attention, but the reality is if I don't stop and really communicate in this way that you're talking about on a much deeper level, I never get past the surface. So if I'm right. trying to push change, innovation, whatever it is I think we should do forward, and I'm not paying attention to the crossed arms and the feet towards the door and mm-hmm. the person shaking their head no when they're saying yes, if I'm not taking a second to pay attention to that, I'm getting incorrect buying signals.
Exactly.
Right? I'm thinking people are buying in, but they're not. And if they're doing that, and I can take a break and say, hey guys, I'm getting the sense that there's some like unsaid stuff in the room. Let's tackle that before I keep going. Like it gives me the opportunity to go deeper and actually get to the real conversation we need to have. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yeah, that's very, very fair to say. In fact, when you said pushing change,
yeah.
I'm challenging a lot of the, another thing with communication is semantics. We use a lot of semantics that put up barriers, and saying pushing change could be one of them. What we want to do is inspire change.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you twist it that way, instead of saying pushing, because pushing will make you feel like you're actually trying to push your agenda, right? So say I'm trying to inspire. If I'm trying to inspire, what I'm going to do is do my best to figure out what motivates you. What is your values? What are the things you want to accomplish in life? What makes you feel good? Because then I can take what the change that I'm looking at and try to fit it into what you need and inspire you to enact an impact change based on how it will help you.
You know, that's great advice. And I think this is in Dan and Chip, the Heath brothers, their book Switch. I think it says something like, people don't fear change, they fear being changed. And you're absolutely right. What I just said was like me pushing my agenda onto you versus mm-hmm. you becoming part of the conversation.
Right.
And actually, I think it's really egotistical to think we have all the answers anyway. We need other people's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why my passion really, everybody's like, you resign from a multi-six-figure job to do nothing. You know, I'm writing the books, but my passion really is to share the things I've learned and others have learned. So I coach, and just like our little communication there, I'll have these coaching conversations with new joiners and new leaders. Not only does it help them feel valued by their organization if they bring me in to help, but it also helps them get over those hurdles versus just jumping ship when they get frustrated.
Right.
And that's, I love that. Large group settings, I really love it because I'm able to impact so many more. I did one at a college, and the, you know, a lot of college kids in there and a couple old timers, and the kids were just, I mean, I had a line of people waiting for their book. I've never seen anything like it, right? They wanted the books. They waited for hours to get their book signed, and they were just in awe. Like, there's nothing like this out there. And then I got an email that just, I have to share it, but it was from one of the old timers. And he said, I sat in this, you know, presentation, and he said, it was kind of refresher for me. I did learn some things about what I need to be a better leader. He's like, but I was astonished to see how many of the young folks in there didn't know a lot of this stuff. I just assumed they did. We forget what we learned and we're awful at sharing it.
Yeah. Well, we kind of take it as obvious, don't we? Like,
yeah,
obviously I know this. So all of you should know this, which is not really how it works. So, okay. So I derailed this on communication, but I think
Sorry,
it's such a big,
I, no, very no, no, no. important. It, very important.
I 100% agree with you, which is why I wanted to dig in. And you said there was a third. So what was that one?
And leadership. Yeah. So, the third deadly, and then that'll be the next book set actually, is leadership and deadly leaders. Because we really don't, especially in the US, we don't educate leadership skills. We don't teach it. We teach management. You go to school, you do your homework, you take your test, you turn in your assignment. Yeah, you're homeschooled. You got to turn in your assignments. You got to write your reports. You got to walk in single file line if you're in class, you know. All of these things our management skills. Mm-hmm. Even when they put us in a group, they're like, here's your job, here's your job, here's your job, and you manage those tasks. There are very few leadership education courses. There are some out there. And some people say, oh, well, what about the military? Well, the military is more a demand and control. As much as someone might want to argue with me, yeah, I'm out in the battlefield and I have to lead my guys. But honestly, they have to do what I say or they get thrown in the brig or they die.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of that way. When the new group coming out, you know, almost 50% of the workforce is millennials. And my kids are in the Gen X group, right? As they're coming out, they want to be inspired. They want to be like, they're used to the internet. My son is making videos and editing stuff. And he read the whole Harry Potter series by first grade, the whole thing, you know, and they don't want somebody sitting and micromanaging them. They want to be given a project and allowed to just fly and then get some feedback because they want to feel like they're adding value. They don't want crap projects. Right. And the leadership skills that we're missing is that we shouldn't be, we need to manage some tasks, but my dream is you don't need managers if you have everyone as a leader. And the reason is because leaders educate, inspire, right? They inspire folks to go out and go above and beyond. They empower them to do it. And they don't make, you know, watch over their every move. They empower them. And then they go in assure and say, you know, are you doing what you said? You know, those check-ins, and then they improve. And that's a true leader. And we don't do that right now. We tell people what to do. We do mid-year reviews to tell them what they're not doing right or they are doing right. And then we do end-of-year reviews and we reward them. Don't even want to get me on this tangent, but you reward them based on, you know, out of a 5-star rating or whatever, which nobody can get 5 stars because,
right.
You know, that means you hung the moon. Well, gosh, why in the world do we have incentive programs designed to tell people they're only average? What's that? I mean, that's such a demotivator.
Well, it's also treating everybody the same, and there are different jobs require different skills.
Yeah, but I still think our incentives should be based on everybody should be able to exceed expectations.
Oh, totally.
Have this bell curve that demoralizes people because I can only pick one, you know?
Right. It was like back to my college days too.
Yeah. That goes into another, like I said, there's so many deadly practices that comes up later even, but leadership as a whole, I think one of the reasons we do such a poor job of if we do clearly define expectations and let's say we communicate it very well, if the leadership's out there beating people over the head or demanding control, not inspiring and empowering, not actually doing assurance to make sure that what they want done is being done. Assurance is not audit, right? It's assessments and going out and readjusting. And if we're not doing those things, then we can have the best expectations in the world, but our culture is going to be so toxic that it's not going to deliver.
What's your one piece of advice or maybe first step? How do you move someone from doing to leadership, regardless of if that's an actual job title promotion or just in their roles? I think, you know, we hire people for being good at something and then we're surprised when they show leadership qualities.
Yeah.
And I think more people could be moved in that direction if we gave them the tools. And again, I think to your point, which is so important, I think leadership can happen at all levels. I think it's a lot like innovation that way. That should be happening at all levels.
Right.
So how do we think about moving people? And perhaps it's our fault as the organization that they're all there to begin with because we've said, do your job.
Right. And that's actually why I decided to take what originally was going to be the most humongous textbook ever and turn it into guidebooks. Mm-hmm. Because with this and the different, you know, deadly practices addressed, organizations anywhere, whether it's a church or it's, you know, a government agency or a Fortune 500 company or just a mom and pop shop, I use these. And I'm a one person with some subcontractors. You know, my company is very, very small. I choose to inspire and partner with people and let them learn and change the world with me. But the books are designed so that you can actually take each chapter, an organization can, and they can have work groups with their folks and start learning leadership as far as, okay, here's one chapter. Let's go through it as a group, right? And let's decide on a project to work on for this quarter for this group, right? And it can be to help that organization. But you learn those leadership skills. One, I can help through the presentations. There's other leadership coaching and training out there. The one I went through is great. But you can take those chapters, break them out, go through them, do a project, and do the whole thing, right? So you're educating them by going through a chapter, and then you inspire them by relating to it personally with your organization, right? And then you empower them to go do something about it. You see how the book's actually breaching leadership skills in a silent kind of way, right? So you empower these folks to go do this project. And then assurance, you just check in. How's the project going? Where are you going with it? There are no rules or limits. Like, you must have this end result, right? It's all to innovation and inspiring folks to do better. Then you have your expectations. You want people to always exceed them, right? That's how you grow. And then at the end, you come back and you have the discussions around the project and presentations, and you have learnings. Okay, this went great. What could we do better? What could I do better as a leader? What resources could we have done to help this? And you have a learning session. And then you go to the next chapter and you apply the learnings to the next topic.
So let me ask you this from the books then, or the guidebooks, and I like that approach to it. What's one tool or tip in there that you've gotten feedback on that people said, wow, we really like this one. It works really well.
All of them. So the feedback I've gotten, I'll go back to that question, but the feedback I've received so far is, oh my gosh, I've never seen anything like this. It's fun to read. It's short. It's to the point, and it's easy. I don't bog it down with names and name calling. I don't put a bunch of research in it. Everybody's like, we want research. We want facts. But the truth is, the young generation, they may see a link, but they don't open it. They take everything. They look at face value. So I'm, you know, that. But as far as a tip in there, there's a couple, but one in there is talking about balance and the importance of balancing our decisions. And I don't know, am I allowed to curse on here or no?
Oh, no, you can. I'm a sailor. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So with the balance, I actually have it patent pending and working on getting it manufactured, because it's a tool that I've been developing for a long time. Because right now, when we make decisions, it's kind of a yes, no, right?
Uh-huh.
We go or not go. And my background in risk assessment, I learned that the yes, no doesn't always cover everything, and you miss a lot of stuff. So I basically took a bow tie approach, which is looking at a risk event, something you don't want to happen, and what could potentially cause it. And then on the other side, if it happened, what would the severity be, the impact to the business? And I put it in this circular scale. I don't know if you've seen the book, but it's a round scale. And it has 3 points I call the 3 P's. So you've got your people in the organization, and that's your leaders, your employees, your people, right? And then you have your public, which includes your market, your environment, stakeholders, all of that. And then you have your performance. And that's the money. So a lot of times, for example, you'll see organizations, oh my gosh, our profits are down, the market's demanding, da-da-da, let's fire people. That'll bring up the profit, you know, it'll make the numbers work. And then they don't take into consideration, one, what does that do to their culture when they fire a bunch of people? When we talk about, oh, employees aren't loyal anymore. Well, duh.
Right.
Look how organizations are acting. They're not having thoughtful decisions around the changes they're making, and they're negatively impacting their culture. They're losing trust. And so the scale says, think about those three different perspectives when you make a decision. And so then, okay, here I am. I'm wanting to fire people. I've got the performance issue. I'm not making the stakeholders happy. The market's not happy. So what happens if I fire people? What happens to the culture? Now, you may still have to let go of people, but by having those considerations and those thoughts, you're able to say, okay, wait, if we fire a bunch of people, this is the impact it's going to have. Maybe we go to the people and say, here's the challenge we're having. right? Here's the challenge we're having. We've done this full evaluation, and it looks like we're going to have to let people go. Do you guys have any ideas for something different? And I can't remember where it was. It was up one of those cold countries.
I think it's a sports brand, right? Or no, you're talking about something else.
There's
a U.S. company that did it too. That's like a sports apparel, maybe Arc'teryx, maybe one of those went to their people, right?
Yeah,
and said, hey, we have a problem.
Yeah. And so the one I'm thinking of was like in Norway or something, but they went to the people and they said, hey, we love this company and we don't want to be let go. We have families to feed. How about we just give up our vacation for this year? And we work through our vacations. Would that help, you know? And doing those type of modifications voluntarily, right, as a group, and you make those decisions and you're clear and transparent, that helps, right? But let's say we do that. We've looked at our performance as low and we've talked to our people and we're going to have them work through their vacations or whatever they decide to do, right, whatever the impact is. And then we go, okay, well, what about the public? What impact is this going to have on the public? So now you look at your reputation. Oh my gosh, they're working them to death, you know, or I can't believe they took away their vacation. You look at the market. How's it going to respond to this? Are they going to respond positively because, hey, you're working with your employees to keep loyalty? Or are they going to respond negatively because, you know, maybe your customers are getting a less quality product because they're, I don't know, but you look at those different impacts of your decision. And what happens is if you don't do that, right? I was just talking about a more balanced approach. If you don't do that and you put these little weights on the scale and all we're talking about is performance, right? And then go over to market. We want to make market happy. What happens when all the weights on those 2 points on a ring scale?
Mm.
So it goes down, right? But
what happens? It's out of balance.
Where does the people go? They go up.
Mm.
And so on the scale, the low is too much focus and above the center point is increased risk. And what I say is if you focus on any one or two categories and ignore the others, then you fuckus things up. So that is an important, I mean, that term, I want to make it in Webster because it's true. I try to avoid using the term focus because, again, it is good to be focused on things, but if you focus too much, then you fuckus things up because you don't consider them all.
Totally. And I also, the other thing I appreciate about that, not just the tool, but the story you shared along with it is if I do have to let people go, having to think about that then forces me to go, now, how do I deal with this in the best way for all of us? So, because I think oftentimes not asking those questions, you miss the next steps because you're not talking about the impact.
Yeah.
So not only could you have an alternative solution, like you said, of going to your people and saying, hey, and I think, I wish I could remember the name of the company. I know sports apparel, like outdoor apparel, but they all took a third pay cut so everyone could stay. And that's an alternative that maybe as management you wouldn't think of. So you have these alternative solutions, and then you also have thinking through the next steps that have to happen ahead of time versus getting caught out and reactive when you get there. I'm just in the essence of time, I want to go to another question because this is something that I've seen you write about. And there was an article, you mentioned something about it too. And that was a culture of ignorance. What does that mean and what's the impact?
Yeah, a culture of ignorance is when we don't know, right? So if leadership are not communicating clearly, or they haven't defined what they want, right? Like, how many organizations don't even know what success looks like?
Right.
They just want to make money.
Yeah.
If they're not, if they don't know what they want and they're not communicating clearly, then you've got a workforce trying to meet expectations that may not be leading you to success or may get you to a small success point, but not sustainable success. Mm. And it's a culture of ignorance. It's not that we're dumb. It's just, we don't know. You don't know. We don't know. And how many people get fired for doing things because they were told to do something a certain way that wasn't feasible or weren't told at all and tried to, you know, fill in the blanks. and they did it wrong. And right. You're fired versus look in the mirror, guys. Did we not only communicate it clearly, but did we set those expectations so they understood them and we held them accountable to it? Because if I have one, you know, if I have five guys doing the same thing and the one does it and something goes wrong and I fire him, but I let the other five keep doing it or the four keep doing it, again, it's a culture of ignorance because they don't realize that they're going to keep doing it the wrong way because you didn't educate them. They didn't learn from it. You just fired the one that you caught.
Right, that you caught. That's the key, right?
Right.
Exactly. Were there any culture killers that you've, in your research and experience, that you found surprising? Like, oh, I wouldn't have expected that to be as bad of an impact as it has. That was horrible English, but you know what I'm saying.
Oh, gosh. There's some because, you know, my background was limited to certain things. One that's come up quite often in talking to other CEOs and world leaders and government officials is, and this came up when I was putting the book together, was the impact of current leadership, right, who are already set in their ways. And as new leaders come in, they're breaking them. So that's why we're in the cycle, right? Because there's nothing.
Right. They have no real good role models.
Yeah, well, that and there's nothing educating the young ones coming in on anything different. So monkey see, monkey do kind of thing. And that was such an eye-opener to me because I originally started writing the book for existing leaders. And I'm like, we got to stop doing these things that we're doing and you know, fix the future. And as I talked to more folks, they said, you're not going to crack that tough nut. This is their way. They've learned they're going to do it this way. You'd be better off just waiting until they die. I've gotten that comment more than once. And that was where I had the aha moment that, oh my gosh, you know, part of culture killers is that we continue to do the same things over and over. And how can we stop that? Well, we got to stop it before it gets into be broken. And so that's shifted the books to more the young
emerging leaders. It makes a lot of sense. When you're saying it makes a lot of sense. It kind of reminds me of family too, you know, is the pair. I have two boys, so they mimic me good and bad. So I've had to really pay attention to my behavior and really recognize like, oh, that's not actually behavior I want them engaging in. So I should probably stop doing that. But you're right. In business, it's really the same. It's really the same thing. And I'll never forget I had this brilliant manager leader at the beginning of my career that really showed me how to be a true leader. And then I had one that was absolutely miserable, but I caught myself picking up some of his behaviors without even meaning to, because that's what I was around all day.
Yes. And that happens. And we're humans, right? No two fingerprints alike. We're humans. We're infallible. We have our own demons and we have our own agendas. And that's not going to change. But what we can influence is to come out there with different perspectives. And the leading better and the communicating better are two points. But the third that's more personal for me to the Leading Beyond Best series is Positively Better, where I actually share my stories. So my dad almost died in front of me when I was 3. I've been in an abusive relationship. I've been fired from jobs. I've been put in unethical situations. You know, you go on and on. But how do we take those negatives in our lives and in our workplace, right? We hate our boss. Why do we hate our boss? You know, you put the 5-why approach to it. Why do we hate our boss? What can we do about it? You know, as you dig down to the whys, you find out what's at the root. And then you go, okay, what can I do to impact that? You know, should I quit or can I do something to influence up?
You know, what's powerful about that too, I think, is we often blame they, right? They don't get it. They're idiots. They like everything is somebody else's fault. And having to take a step back and ask the why of like, we'll just use the boss as an example. Why do I think he sucks? Why is he not getting the brilliance of this proposal that I have? You know, why? And going through that process really forces you to own how to move things forward versus allowing, or not even allowing, but transferring that kind of blame over to the people on the other side of the table, because I think we all work with those people, don't we? On the other side, they were like, why don't they get it? But that forces you to really kind of look inward a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless we have a brain chip we can stick in somebody and physically control them, we cannot control people.
Turns out all we
can do is control ourselves and impact ourselves and influence others. And we've got to change the mindset to understand that. And that's a huge eye opener for me. And it's really helped me with conversations and others to really get to the heart of what is the issue.
And I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier too, about really thinking about what's in it for them. What are they, you know, what can you do to serve them a little bit? You said it in a little different words, but that kind of idea around not just like me put, it was about me pushing, right, my change, but how do I inspire that to them? What do they need to have happen to make it work for them?
Right. Right. And that's why I have the journey, right? I'm asking folks to join the journey, because as more and more folks, yourself included, start learning these valuable skills, I can't do it alone. Right. And so on the journey, I'm asking for others to partner with me and to share the journey and spread the word so that we can make an actual difference to the future. I want my kids, and I'm sure you do too. I have two boys as well. I want them to grow up in a world where they love what they do and they love to go to work.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
And they have good work-life balance, which we don't have right now. I mean, people in China are dropping dead from working too much. Literally, it's an epidemic. So I don't want to go that direction.
I don't either.
I want it to change. I want it to get better. And I'm hoping you decide to join the journey with me as well. We'll keep sharing it. Yeah.
So on that note, where can people go to jump on that journey with you?
Yeah, my website is TALaser, LAS with a S, not a ZER.com. And they can join the journey on the website. They can communicate with me through there. All my social media feeds are open. I don't have a mute button and I have no secrets. So if you want to know anything, just reach out and let me know, and I'd be happy to work with you.
Maybe I should have asked you what's one secret, but I'm just kidding. I can't believe we're out of time. What's your final piece of advice for leaders of, you know, all levels out there trying to build a culture of success and not kill the culture around them?
Yeah, my final bit of advice, and you'll see this come out this week too, is we need to stop leading down. We're hindering our ability to grow. Start leading from the basement so you can support your organization's growth, and flip the script. Lead from the basement, support your growth.
So does that mean, just so I'm clear, does that mean lead up, meaning like the people that you report to versus your team? Or does that mean all around you? How do you think about leading up?
Yeah, I think of leading up as you clearly define the expectations, whether it's for the whole organization or your department or whatever it may be. And you clearly define those expectations and you build that foundation to support it. And then you, like I said, lead. You educate them on the expectations. You inspire them to go out and build your success as big and as great as you can. You empower them to do it. You give them the resources and support to do it. You go out and just check them every once in a while. You're in the basement, but you come up to, you know, you don't want to stay there, but you're holding up the organization or your department or your agency or whatever. And if you look at it from the bottom and from the basement holding up, then you stop thinking of yourself as above others. And if you're at the top, thinking you're leading down, you're really just an obstruction to growth. And the only way the organization can grow is if they backstab you, lie to you, climb over you. And that's not
a good place to be.
And that's what we have now. We have a bunch of leaders that say they're at the top, and growth is not healthy.
Tabitha, that was great final advice. And I'm now very hyper aware of where my feet are focused or pointed. So thank you so much for coming by.
Yes, no, I loved it. Thank you for having me. I love the questions.
Hey, did you get something out of that episode? I hope that you did. Before you go, do me a favor and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Remember, more reviews equals more listens, and that equals more rock star guests for you. Really, it's a selfish endeavor to go give us a review. Okay, Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.